to say good morning, you have to say, because if you don't do that, the person see you in the street, you don't say that. When he saw your mom
home,
or your dad, your mother is going to tell, oh, I see your son is okay.
Yeah, so I welcome you to join us again here next time on WGXC 90.7 FM. Join the conversation.
Yes.
Elsa Levasseur, and I'm a sustaining member, and I give monthly on the internet. It's so easy to listen to WGXC Accra.
On January 28, 2022, Wave Farm Incorporated, licensee of WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra, New York, filed an application with the Federal Communications Commission for the renewal of its license. Members of the public wishing to view this application or obtain information about how to file comments and petitions on the application can visit publicfiles.fcc.gov and search in WGXC's public file.
On Monday, February 28th, tune in all sorts of creative community voices on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM, including at 9 a.m., on the WGXC Morning Show, Rob Gellis and his Rob Around the County segment speaks to Todd Smith, who attended the Hudson Boys and Girls Club as a youth and later managed the Hudson Youth Center. 10 a.m. is time for the Afrosonic Taxi with tracks today from Margareth Menez, Chico Cesar, Makina Loca, and others. At noon, the Deep Three Show features works today from Maya Hersey, Anthony Coleman, Rachel Miller, and others. 2 p.m., we've got brand new music from around the world on the Vital Weekly Show, including songs from Pierre Juilliard, Lisa Olin, and BJ Nilsson. Tracking the Odds at 3 p.m. from the Roulette Intermedium space in Brooklyn features works from Jared Lauder, recorded at Roulette. At 4 p.m., we go to the WGXC Afternoon Show live in Western Massachusetts in Housatonic, Kieran Riley as your host for 2 hours. Then the WGXC Congressional Report is included on the All Together Now news program at 6 p.m. And Everything All the Time from Rob Van Irv is on at 8 p.m., followed by the Bantu Notes radio show with music from Gilberto Gil, Earl Sweatshirt, Bamba Estéreo, and others on 90.7 FM WGXC.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farm's radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Elizabeth Powell Leather Items of Craryville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
The Hudson schools are hosting community budget workshops on March 1st, March 15th, and April 5th ahead of the school vote on the budget. You can turn out to learn more about the proposed budget for the Hudson schools this year on either March 1st, March 15th, or April 5th, and find out more about these events in the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
Good evening. I'm Kevin Factor, and this is Foraging Ahead. These last 2 years, during the pandemic, people have described being in lockdown as sort of being in prison. And ironically, a good deal of art and music and poetry and literature has come out of this enforced dormancy in our lives. Tonight's guest is an artist and a poet, and he has had lots of time to own his craft and to discover himself. Hector has been in prison since he was 21, and tonight I talk to him about his life, his art, what it's like being a father in prison, and how do you even begin to attempt restitution for the crime that you committed. He's thoughtful, and his story is compelling, and I'm just going to let him speak. We did it over the phone through the prison system, so bear with me. Sometimes the quality of the audio isn't great. You may have to turn your volume up, but it's worth it, and it's worth hearing Hector and his thoughts and what he has to say. Hector.
An incarcerated individual at New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Preventing suicide is important. If you have concerns during this call, please contact the individual's facility to communicate with them.
To accept charges, press 1. To refuse charges, thank you for using Securus. You may start the conversation now.
Hola. Hello. Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing, Hector?
I'm doing good. It's good to hear you.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks for calling and chatting with me. Can we talk a little bit about your art to start out with?
Yes.
So tell me, when did you first start painting?
Actually painting, I was probably like 12 years old. Yeah, but it wasn't that type of painting. I found myself in my grandmother's backyard with a whole bunch of stone. There was like some paint somewhere. It was white paint. And in Puerto Rico, I'm from Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
And in Puerto Rico, they use white paint to paint the trunks of trees, like on the streets.
Is that right? What?
Yes. Not all the time, but you see it a lot. And that image stood with me, but I wanted to paint the stones. We had like a lot of stones, so I just painted the stone. So that would probably be the first time that I painted. But it wasn't like an image of anything. It was just, I was bored maybe.
So did you move on from painting stones? And do you remember the first time you just like, you painted an image? Were you still a kid, or?
Yeah, yes. The second time, now I was in Long Island, New York. I was living with my older sister who used to work in Hofstra University, and she bought me some acrylic paint, little tubes. And at that time, I used to like the character Sanity Sam. Yeah, so I drew him on a pair of overall that she had bought me. It was blue. Overall jeans. So I painted a Samurai Sam there, and that was it. You know, I never went back to it or anything. I drew it and painted it. And I was 13, 14 there. Then many years later, in prison, I would use coloring pencil to color, but I didn't really know how to draw. I was just trace things. Like mouth and stuff like that. And I would color them in, and some of the guys would like it, and I would exchange it for like Snicker bars or things like that. That was in like about 95, 96. When I came upstate New York, I came upstate in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself in Green Haven Correctional Facility, and all I did was work out because there was nothing else that I could do at that time. But they had a hobby shop, and people there did leather work. and I got involved in it. There was a guy there that had all the patience in the world to teach me how to use the tools and stuff like that. So I did that for a long time until I got real good at it. And the facility closed down the hobby shop because of, you know, the races, the extractor knife races that you use to cut the leather and all of that ended up throughout the facility, so they shut down that program. And that's when I was interested in painting.
Mm.
I was like, then I got to do something. But I always felt that to be a good artist, you have to do portraits or landscape. And since I didn't know how to do neither one of them, I felt that I didn't fit in. But somehow I ran into Basquiat, his different style of drawing,
mm-hmm.
another artist. And I was like, well, I could do that. I like that. And that's when I got into more of a surrealistic art form.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would do it, and it was different. And some people would like it. But they would probably like more the colors that I used than the actual image that I was drawing. So I started using colors, but the colors started reminding me of Puerto Rico.
Mm.
Live colors that you see like in the houses. They paint the pastel colors that they use over there and the clothes that they use over there. So I don't know if it's subconsciously somewhere in my mind. Those are the colors that I like to use. Now, I noticed that as I started drawing figures, I would draw a lot of women with breasts, right? The guys would make fun of me. They were like, oh, heck, this is a freak. He likes breasts. There's always a breast in his drawings. They said, this is the only guy that would put, like, a breast on a butterfly or a breast on a tree. So what they didn't understand, didn't know was that when I grew up without my mother, right? And
mm-hmm.
I have very many images of being with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
The one image that stood with me is that one day I saw her breastfeed one of my younger sister.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, that meant life.
Mm-hmm.
My mother giving life to her child. So in honor of that vision and in honor of my mother giving life to my sister, I always paint like trees and stuff like that. I like to paint women in forms that I think are powering. I think trees is like a symbol of power because they outlive most of us and stuff like that. So, and that's somehow how it led me to that. But once I started figuring out that that's what I was doing and I started connecting it, then I just focus more on it, because at first I was just doing it, but I kept asking myself, why am I always doing this? Because I find myself doing it, and it's not that I'm so in love with women's breasts, because that's not really the part of the woman's body that really calls my attention. You know, to the guys, they think that that's what it is, and it don't have nothing to do with that. It has something to do with the image.
That's a question I think a lot of people don't ever ask themselves. You know, like, why am I doing this? You know, or why do I need to do this? Or why is this image or these thoughts, why do they recur? And the fact that you sort of dove into that, you kind of figured it out for yourself. That's really cool and interesting.
I've been in prison 27 years. I'm going on 27 years this December.
Wow.
I just turned 21 when I got locked up.
Mm.
And in prison, I've noticed that really your taxpayers' money is going to waste. My family taxpayers is going to waste. And I feel that society don't understand that their taxpayers is going into a system that is humiliating other human beings that's coming from poor communities. I feel that should be exposed. I feel that if society have a good understanding that their money is not making the streets safer, if anything, is turning people probably, I'm not going to say that the prison does that. What I'm going to say is that in prison, there's nothing good in prison to help individuals in prison to better themselves. And the money that is going into keeping these places up is a waste of the taxpayers' money. That money should be going into schools. It should be going into other aspects of society where society could benefit better from than prison. Not too long ago, this prison right here where I was at, where I'm at, was locked down and had an institutional search, which means they bring a special team into the facility and they search the whole facility. Special team is made out of volunteers, officers from all over the state, and when they come to the prison, they feel that the superintendent has lost power over the prison. So what they do is they take power back, and the way that they make sure to take power back is by letting you know that you're powerless and any move or anything you say will cause you with pain. So when they came in here, they hurt a lot of people. It caused pain to a lot of people because they couldn't keep their hands up long enough or because they were shaking because the window was frozen. You know, the window was open, it was cold, and they in their boxes and slippers in front of a open window. You know, in the in almost 27 years that I've been in jail, this has been, in prison, this has been my third institutional search like that. They always have lockdowns, but like that where they bring a special team, that was my third one. And it was probably the one that impacted me the most. And it impacted me the most because I understand the intentions behind it. You know, I'm also a student at BPI, and I've learned about structural settings, you know, how we know society is constructed. And I understand that this whole prison system is the whole prison industrial complex is a business. And it's not designed to rehabilitate me. I'm getting rehabilitated because of the education that I'm getting, the social network that I've managed to build with people on the outside that cares enough to hear my story. Now, what is it about me that keeps me going in a place like this? But it's not the prison and it's not the programs the prison are putting forth because the teachers, they get paid to teach here, they don't teach. It's a waste of taxpayers' money. You know, at one time I used to think that it was a waste of time and a waste of life, but then I realized that that's my choice, right? I get to decide if my life is going to be a waste, going to be a waste. You don't get to decide that for me. And I changed that way of thinking. I don't think about that anymore.
Do you remember the moment where you made that decision? How old were you? I mean, again, I mean, Hector, you seem like an exceptional person to me, just from talking to our mutual friend and also just hearing you talk about your art and your life. Do you remember that moment when you found the power to make the decision to do art, to get an education, to move in this positive direction?
You know, when I got locked up for this crime, it was in 1995, and under Pataki had brought back the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And because my crime consists of a felony murder, which means that you commit a felony while committing a murder, you're eligible for the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
So I was considered for the death penalty. And I wasn't scared of dying on death row or anything like that because somehow in my mind something told me that's not going to be you. In other words, that's not going to be me. So that wasn't scaring me, but I asked myself, how did I get here? Like, did I end up taking another man's life? How did I end up facing all of this? And now I have my family who've tried to help me suffering. And so I had to dig deep and think, like, yo, how did I end up here? And I came to the conclusion that ever since my mother abandoned me, I've lived in a roller coaster ride of rage and frustration and confusion. You know, I live in many different households where my mother left me behind. I lived with my grandfather for a few, I can't really remember exact time, but maybe a couple of months before he got sick and died. And an aunt of mine adopted me, and she introduced me to morals, principles, and values that there were Christians' moral principles and values, but they were good enough to keep me out of trouble if I were to follow those. Sadly, she died of breast cancer. I only lived with her for like 2 years. So from the age of 5 to 7, I lived with her. And an uncle from Philadelphia picked me up and told me I was going to live with him. So I went from a household where I learned the simple things. I learned table manners, etiquette, how to behave around people and stuff like that, to a household where my uncle was a drug dealer, was a drug user, very abusive to his wife and us and the children. So at the age of 8, I learned how to sell drugs. My first word in English was, I got it, meaning when the drug fiends would put their money through the mail slot, I would pick it up and I'll yell, I got it. I'll run upstairs and give it to my aunt and uncle, and they'll throw the drug out the window. So for about 6 years that I lived in the household, I learned how to sell drugs. I learned how to bag drugs. I learned how to fight, because in one of the rules in my household was, you don't get bullied. If I find out you get bullied, you will get an ass whipping. So for those 6 years of living and experiencing that, that's all I learned. I became that. You know, and I compare it to Michael Vick's treatment of his pit bulls, because pit bulls in society have this stigma where they're wild dogs, and they're not bad dogs. It's we make them bad. And the social circumstances that I was living in turned me into that wild pit bull. Mm-hmm. I had no problem hurting anybody who I felt right? was a threat.
And did you attend school in Philadelphia while you were living there?
I attended school very little. I cut a whole lot of school. But yes, I was enrolled in school, but I did more cutting classes than I did attending classes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up in Puerto Rico, and when I ended up in Puerto Rico, I threatened my way out of my uncle's grip on me, because I threatened to call the cops on him and tell him everything that I knew about him, so he let me go, and that's how I ended up in Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm in prison, and now I'm saying, how did I end up here? And I going back to my mother, it's like, yo, my mother never made an attempt to rescue me from all these situations.
Mm.
So I was very mad at my mother. I hated my mother, but I knew that I can't keep committing crime. And if I get out of this one, this cannot be my life. It can't. So through other programs, like parenting programs, I learned that in life we are like a revolving door. You are going to raise your child most likely based on how you was raised. Changes and educate yourself, you're going to make the same mistake or probably worse mistake than your parents. But when I learned that, I learned that I had to forgive my mother. You know, my mother was abused and she was a child. You know, I was 9. When I was born, she was 19 years old. My father was 52 years old. One of my sisters went to school with my mother in Puerto Rico. So I can't blame my mother. So I made an attempt to find her and let her know that I no longer blame her. I understand why I was enraged, why I was angry, why I wanted to resolve everything through violence.
Mm-hmm.
And once I understood that that's not something that I wanted to do, is when I started looking for programs that I would go and it would help me articulate my thoughts or express myself in ways that I didn't learn growing up. And that's what led me to thinking differently and always looking for something different, because I just knew that prison could not be the rest of my life, even though at that moment I was facing life or death in prison.
How many other people who are in prison do you think ask themselves those questions that you asked yourself that led you to the path that you're on right now? I imagine everybody in prison must ask themselves that question, or not. I don't know. Like, do you have any thoughts on that? Do you know any?
Obviously, I cannot speak for everybody in prison, but I like to think that most people in maximum security prison ask themselves that, because the difference between a max and a medium facility is that in a max, you are in a huge box, right? There's a huge wall that keeps you from seeing society. You don't know what society looks like. You only have images in your mind, or if you're looking at the news or whatever, but you forget society, and now you learn how to live there. And at the end of the night, with that gate closed, that you're alone, and eventually the noise kind of settled down in the company, you think, and you start, maybe you don't ask yourself that question, but you evaluate, like, yo, what can I do different? But then the thing is that I like to believe that every prisoner asks that question in different ways. Not everybody voices that question. Some people are just, you know, they stick around a program, or they stick around people that are doing positive things, and they just don't know how to word, I need help. And so I feel that people who recognize that they are changing their life should be mindful and be aware of other ways people express their voice that is not vocal. But I like to think that a lot of us do ask that question. We just don't know who to ask it to, where to get the help. You know, we can ask it to ourselves, but if you don't have the tools to kind of break that down, then, you know, it's hard to get an answer for, or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. How do you get yourself? How do you get the tools? How do you even know that there are tools if you never grew up with those sort of models and seeing people function in a different way?
Let me add something else to that. Right.
Go on.
There's this thing where, for example, the way I grew up where the way you get respect is by hurting somebody else, right? If I have a reputation of hurting people, then other people are going to respect me, right? That's the way I used to think. I have respect like this. It didn't even cross my mind that it's not respect, it's that they fear. So they're not giving me respect, they are fearing me. So I come into a system like prison. They have this I call it toxic masculinity, right? In order to survive in this place, either you have to be a mastermind thinker, or you have to be very aggressive, or at least pose the threat, the potential of being a threat, right? And before I came upstate, a friend of mine gave me a book by Machiavelli. He said, this is my Bible, right? So the book, and I study it. I said, interesting, right? So I learned that if I don't say much, cannot figure me out. And if you cannot figure me out, chances is you're not going to mess with me, right? And it worked for me, right? So once I got in my mind that all I have to make you think that I'm a threat to you, you're not going to mess with me. And that has worked for me for the whole entire time that I've been in prison, right? But it also built a wall that is so hard to break down. Because when you want to play the role of being stoic and being this macho man and all of that stuff, you start building walls where there's other aspects of you where maybe you want to cry, maybe you want to talk about personal things, but you can't do it because it just doesn't fit the environment, the culture in here. And so if you don't have an outlet of a friend or a family, then how do you cope with that? At that time, how I coped with it was I would write everything on a letter, and once I felt empty, I would rip it and flush it down the toilet. And that was my way of coping with a lot of frustration and anger in prison, was just writing it down and flushing it. Sometimes I would find little things that I would write, and I'd read it, and I was like, yo, I am full of rage. I am full of hate. I can't be this person. So, and I'll be like, why am I still thinking like this? And it always pushed me to look for other programs to help me. And programs that I've been in, professors have suggested other programs, and I've taken on other programs, and little by little, it has worked for me. But it wasn't that, yes, I decided to make the choice and ask the question and look for the answer, But it wasn't alone. It was every professor, every civilian who came in, who decided to somehow guide me.
What strikes me that is sort of the irony of what a person in prison needs, you know, that sort of self-reflection, that admitting vulnerability, you know, knowing that you need help and seeking help. But you also, like you said, are in a situation where toxic masculinity is the norm, and for you to show that vulnerability,
you have 1 minute left.
That vulnerability that you need to admit and show in order to move out of that rage is dangerous, isn't it?
It is very dangerous, but there's a way to do it, right? Sometimes you just gotta, if you're tough to do something, you have to be tough for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You fight for yourself and you surround yourself around positive people.
Mm-hmm.
They will protect you as well.
Mm.
So now you become a part of a community of like-minded people.
Mm.
And before you know it, those individuals who are also sick of being part of this whole toxic masculinity, they look for a way out, and at least you're providing them with a path, you know what I'm saying, or a community to be part of. So, yes, it's rough. It's not easy. Peer pressure is very heavy. In this
Thank
time.
You for using Securus. Goodbye.
Would get cut off after a half hour. That's just how the phone system works. You get 2 half-hour chunks a day that you have to sign up for ahead of time. So our conversations, and we had 4 or 5 of them, would get cut off, and we'd have to resume. But I'm going to continue my chat with Hector and his art and his life in prison and his thoughts on how to reform a system and address the inequalities that exist for so many of us.
An incarcerated individual at New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Preventing suicide is important. If you have concerns during this call, please contact the individual's facility to communicate with them.
To accept charges, press 1. To receive charges, thank you for using Securus.
You
may start the conversation
to,
now.
You're wanting to be a better parent than your mother was, right? I thought of that section in the Bible. I don't know how familiar you are with the Bible, but there was God says to this is the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament. He says, "I'm a vengeful God. If you disobey me, I will curse you and your sons and your sons' sons to the seventh generation." And I always thought, God, what a jerk, you know, that he would do that, you know, that he would curse the great 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 grandchildren of somebody because they did something that God didn't like. But then when you sort of take a step back and you think about it, you're like, well, this is, you know, a Bronze Age people trying to understand how things work. And, yeah, if you have trauma in a family, it's going to work its way through generations unless somebody stops it. You made that decision to stop this. He said it's a vantage that his father is in prison. He don't know his father from taking him to school. He don't know his father from playing baseball or anything with him. He only knows his father of coming to visit him in the visiting room. Through phone conversations and through letters and stuff like that. I always knew that I did not want to be the father that I never had or the mother that I never had. But again, how do I change that? So I had to look for the help in different places, and people that I just look up to, that I like how they, I don't know how they parent, then I would try to learn as much. Sometimes you don't have the tools, but sometimes your intuition, there's something in you that kind of lets you know this is wrong. You just have to take the time out to understand what your mind is telling you. You know, you may not know where it's coming from, but it's just something that speaks to you and tell you there's something wrong here. You got to work on it. You got to fix it. So one thing about me and parenting with, you know, my son is that I don't lie to him. I don't feel that I should lie to him. Doesn't mean that I'm going to tell him everything. You know, I think you talk to your child depending on his or her level of understanding. You gotta find a way to talk to them so that they could understand what you're saying. You know, my son at one time, he glorified me because of the reputation that I left behind. So I had to write him a letter and explain to him why he cannot glorify the person that I left behind, because I'm ashamed of the person that I left behind. The person that I left behind is now in prison, who gets humiliated every time he goes on a visit, because when I go on a visit, I have to strip. I have to, run my fingers through. I don't have hair, but if you have hair through your hair, open your mouth, lift up your private parts, bend over, spread your butt cheeks. Those are things that are designed to break a human being. So if that led me to, you know, to this, this is nothing to glorify. It's just of what it's doing to me. But what happened to how my actions hurted the family or the person's life that I took? What happened to every family that I sold drugs to their family members? So once he understood this and I made it clear to him that my actions are not to be glorified, because if he glorified that, he's glorifying something that's causing me pain and shame. And he kind of understood. He understood that no, that's not what it is. So, you know, it hasn't been easy, yes. But I think what worked is what worked for me was explaining to him why people glorify certain things, and that a person is not the same in a crowd as when he or she is alone. And stuff like that. So once I was able to explain certain things to him, I think he kind of got it. I found out from his mother that he was getting in trouble in school, and a neighbor caught him with a BB gun. I saw that I had to write this letter to him. So I wrote, "Dear Hector, I am left with, Dear Hector, all I am left with are words of my past, so that you can shape up an idea of who your dad was and where I came from. Words of wisdom obtained from 2 decades of lashing solitude inside the state penal system. Words trenched by the pain of feeling purposeless, hopeless, and useless because I cannot rescue you from your adolescent years. Words of who I aspire to be, so that you're able to see and understand that there's nothing that through hard work, dedication, and sacrifice you can achieve. Words is all I have. All I have for you. For I don't have a dime, much less a penny, to send to you. Words, words, words. Why aren't they working their magic? What is it about my ignorant and fruitless years that you so much idolize? Did I not share with you how my dignity keeps getting stripped of its values every time I bend at the knees and spread my butt cheeks for an officer to see that I am not concealing any weapons, drugs, or money? Words is all I have to give you. Please, take my words. Allow them to marinate in your brain and try to understand why I'm losing my head inside a steel cage, which is inside of a cement box, away from society, sight, and mind. Reminding me daily that my next step just might be a pine box."
The world has changed since, when did you go, in 1998, something like that?
Yes.
The world has changed, and...
No. I got locked up in December 7, 1995.
Oh,
95. I came upstate in 1998, March 1998.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think? I don't know the length of your sentence, but I imagine
I got sentenced to 28 years to life. I see the parole board this coming October.
Okay.
And they decide what they're going to do with me. They should let me go home or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about your hopes, your fears, like once you're getting out? I'm sure you've thought a good deal about it, but
Well, one of the things that is heavy on my mind is not having a place to go to, right? I have a friend who has volunteered his basement, right?
Mm.
But I know that going back there is going back to people and places that I no longer want to be a part of.
Mm.
So, you know, knowing that is like, okay, thank you for offering that, but I cannot go there because I'm not that person. And I still want to continue with my education. You know, by the time I finish here, I should be finishing my bachelor, but I want to go to, you know, get a master's degree in public health. And so I can't do that if I go back to a neighborhood. It's not providing me with the resources that I need to keep with my education and you know, the way I'm thinking today. So that is a fear that I have. You know, I've managed to meet good people that somehow I believe it will help guide me through the process of coming home. I've been away for a long time. There's a lot that I don't know that I need to learn. But I want to learn, you know. I want to go through that because I don't want to be in prison. If going through a shelter or whatever it is that I have to go through, then that's just what I have to do. You know, I've made up my mind that there's no going back.
Could you take us through like a typical day, in your life?
A typical day today in my life?
Yeah.
Well, a typical day in my life today is I wake up early in the morning, 5:30.
Mm-hmm.
I get ready for a program. You know, I have a program where I go and I assign other prisoners job duties and stuff like that.
But you got an alarm clock? How do you?
I have a stopwatch that have an alarm, but I wake up before the alarm wakes me up. It's just inside. I have a clock inside, internal clock that just wakes me up.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that. I get ready around 7:30. I go downstairs and I make the list of the guys that are supposed to work that day.
Work where? Work do what?
They'll come and sweep or mop, depending on where their housing unit is at. You keep them as close to their housing unit. They sweep and mop there. And basically, this facility is they want to keep everybody doing something. The people that come to my job is just people that got to the facility and they're waiting for a program. Program could be industry, Mensor, college, the Puppy Behind Bars program. It could be a whole bunch of programs. Getting one of those programs. They just come through my job, which is called Porter Pool, and I just assign them a job, and they do it real quick, and then they go about their business. After I finish that, I'll come back upstairs. I'll probably make some breakfast, and then if I'm working on a drawing, I'll work on that. If I got homework to do, I'll do a whole lot of reading, and that'll take most of all my day. And in the evening, I always check the kiosk to see if I have emails, send emails back out, and use the phone, you know, shower, and go back to reading and drawing and stuff. That's basically a typical day for me.
Mm.
Some guys, a typical day for them is going to the yard, working out, again, twice or three times a day. when I first came off stage, that's what I used to do. In the morning, I used to work out. In the afternoon, I used to work out. And at nighttime, I used to work out. You do different parts of the body and stuff like that, but you have no other avenue to release the stress and the anxiety. Do something.
And what about meals? Like you said, you made yourself breakfast. You've got a kitchen in your room.
So the housing unit, every housing unit has a kitchen. Now, obviously the facility provides us with 3 meals a day. Breakfast would be like around 7. Lunch is around 12, and dinner is around 4:30, around there, close to 5. But I don't go to the mess hall. I don't go to the mess hall because I don't like the food in the mess hall. I'm pre-diabetic, and the food in the mess hall is either high fructose corn syrup. Well, it just doesn't work for me, so I don't eat it. I prefer to go to commissary and buy food or ask my family and friends for packages, and I eat up for that. So what I do is I eat one solid meal a day, and then later on at night I might eat oatmeal or something like that. So I've managed to just have like 2 meals a day like that, and that's what's worked for me.
Is anything like that people would be surprised who have never been to prison or outside? I mean, like, this is kind of all new to me, you know. Like, I know you were really young when you went in, but I imagine you had some notions of what prison would be like when you went in, and probably a lot of other people have some misconceptions about what prison is like. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. You know, when I got locked up, you know, they kind of, somebody come along and tells you, if you want to survive in prison, you just mind your business, you don't gamble, and you stay away from homosexual acts. If you manage to do those 3 things, you're good, right? So, you know, I don't gamble. I've never been a gambler. I'm not into homosexuality. And I've always stood kind of to myself, so all of that, I said all of that. But that doesn't guarantee that you stay out of trouble. There's somehow, some way, trouble tend to kind of find you at times, and you just got to know how to manage it. You know, in prison, for me, when I first came up stay, because I was Puerto Rican, then all the Puerto Rican would want to recruit me, right? And that's no longer me, that I cannot be part of a gang. You kind of, like, have to put a pushback against your own people and let them know, like, no, that's not going to happen, right? So what they do is they kind of, like, marginalize you, right? Well, you're not one of us, then you're on your own. You got on your own and stuff like that. So that's something that you know, coming in prison, a lot of people think that prison, oh, you got to be careful. Like, they got sexual jokes, like, you don't drop the soap or people get raped in prison, whatever. The whole time I've been in prison, I have never seen nobody get raped or anything like that. Doesn't mean that doesn't happen. I just never seen anything like that. But I know that in prison, if you mind your business, then you're just good. I just think that if people were to understand that prison is like a funnel, right? The people in prison is from the bigger problem in society, and I think society will have more of a compassion, right? I don't see anybody in society with a good conscience that would, you know, if you know that a child is autistic, right, I don't think that you would take personal anything that child would do, because you already know that the child is autistic. If you know that prison, the majority of the people in prison are coming from these poor communities where education is poor, there's no job, there's a lot of abuse, whether it's physically, emotionally, psychologically, then you should view them different. And you should say, well, what's their story? Like, what's your story? Tell me your story. And then maybe people would learn that we have more in common than the things that we don't. It's just that we are at a disadvantage. And we end up being a product of our environment, because at the end of the day, we all kind of want to survive, right? and one was best for our family, but we only have limited tools to work with. You know, so, you know, America has this thing where if you work hard, you can make it. But that's not really true, because we both could work hard, but if I'm being, you know, deprived of a job because of my race, then that alone is I'm at a disadvantage. So if my schooling is very poor, then I'm at a disadvantage. Then how hard can I work? I got to work three times as hard as somebody that doesn't have those challenges. You know? And that's what prison is. Prison is all these people in here. And, you know, now your taxpayers' money is going into that, but it's not helping those people in there. Here's people that take their time out to volunteer in here. They are the one that's helping. And they're not getting one penny. They're the one that should be getting all the taxpayers' money. But not the people that the states are hiring, because they're not doing anything. And just that, I think that if society could understand that there's real human being in prison, and they're willing to hear somebody's story, they might have a change of heart. And I think that they should.
Had you not been in prison, I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate here. Had you not been in prison, do you think you'd still have become an artist and had that curiosity of mind to learn and to really reach beyond where pretty much society ever expected you to be?
Probably not. So I think that from the age of 7 to the age of 13, the abuse that I live and experience shaped me in a certain way. So when I moved to Long Island with a sister who ran a program at Hofstra University called Upper Bound and worked with at-risk youth and all of that, and she went and got all type of tutors and help for me, when she asked me, what do you want to be? I told her, drug dealer. That didn't work because my mind was already messed up. And I found my way into what I knew already with my uncle, which was selling drugs. So I would either end up in prison or dead, because that was what I was living. Had I had a different upbringing, then yes, maybe. But art didn't call my attention. You know, I was dealing with frustration of not understanding why my mother left me. I doubt that not understanding that would have allowed me to take advantage of a sister who did everything to provide me with everything that I can. Advantage of it. No, I think that I would have had that opportunity. So it took me seeing the people around me suffering and knowing that I didn't want to suffer anymore to make the changes that I had to make.
So it sounds like you feel, because of that period of time in your childhood where you just were exposed to the worst that human beings can do, or you know, and that ending up in prison or dead was an inevitability.
Yeah, I believe that children are like sponges, right? Everything that you introduce them to, you got to be very careful, because they're going to absorb that. And if you don't help them digest certain things, then they draw their own conclusions to things. Then you have what I call like vultures in neighborhoods who see a younger person, in my case, a person that was like a live firecracker, and take advantage of him. I could use him to do this and do that. And so then your child become a victim of all of that, right? Yes, you know, I think that how a child is educated and she or he is exposed to, that plays a major role in the decision-making that child is going to make. Yeah, because I learned how to solve my problem with my fist. When I was going to school in Long Island, I got kicked out of school for fighting. Everything you solve your problem with your fist. You don't go talk, you just go solve it with your fist. you know, if you have the right attitude, which I think this is an example, right? Like today I have a different attitude and I'm in an environment that's very toxic, but I'm not participating in the toxic system of this environment is because today I'm aware of what I'm doing, right? As a child, I wasn't aware what I was doing. I was just doing, and I had nobody to guide me differently. And by the time I ran into somebody who tried to guide me, she didn't also understand of everything I was going through because I wouldn't open up to her. I wouldn't tell her I went through this. I went through this kind of help. I was just a quiet kid.
No, I've had kids like you. I mean, as a teacher.
Yeah.
And is there anything that anybody could have done? You think when you were going to school down there that could have turned you around? Was there any other adults that connected with you?
Yeah. So this is what I think. Right. Growing up with my aunt that took me from my grandfather and showed me what love is and the proper way to behave and all these things.
Mm-hmm.
I witnessed certain things happen to her, right? She decided to become a Pentecostal, and one time a van came to pick us up, and because she had jeans, she couldn't go to church. She had to go inside, take off her jeans, put on a long skirt, and take off the makeup. The embarrassment in my aunt's face was still with me, right? I think that right then and then I couldn't tell what was going on. But later on, I was able to figure out that this whole patriarchal thing is designed to keep women humiliated. So I'm learning all these things, and I'm learning how to put the pieces together. Then I know that I don't want to hurt nobody. I don't want to be a cause of hurt. I want to be a cause of maybe solving some type of problem. I love helping people, right? I think everybody needs help. You just have to learn how to read the different language because everybody's not going to voice it vocally, express it. I've been part of a program here called RTA, which means rehabilitation through the arts, where they do a lot of theater program, and I was in the steering committee, and I had to deal with a lot of people that was...
You have 1 minute left.
The phone is going to cut off. I cannot call you back this time. But
thank you for using Securus. Goodbye.
So you're up for parole very soon.
Yes.
From your end, what does that process entail?
Well, based on other people's experience with the parole board, it's hard to really read the parole board because sometimes people get denied because of the nature of their crime and all the accomplishment they have accomplished in prison. Seems to not be considered. I have not had that experience yet, so I cannot really speak about it. But my concern is that I've managed to stay out of trouble for all this time, and I've managed to look for positive avenues to improve myself, change my way of thinking, and I didn't do it for the parole board. I did it for myself. I want to go home. I want to go to my family. I want to return to society. So I'm hoping that everything that I've done is considered, not taking away from the seriousness of the crime that I committed. Obviously, I did commit a crime that's very serious, but I hope that the opportunity is given to me where I could show that I could be a productive member of society. A lot of guys here are looking for the same opportunity.
So can we talk a little bit about the victim?
So New York State has this thing where you can write an apology letter to the family and you send it to Albany, and Albany contact the family and let them know that if they're ready, pass the letter there for them. I'm sure there have been people who contacted the family directly. I have not contacted the family directly. I wouldn't mind to have a conversation with a family directly. But I don't know if that's something that a family would want. But I